is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The war in Ukraine. What can we see? What can we assume of reports about what appears to be sabotage? The report from AP. A spate of explosions and fires has turned Russian-occupied Crimea from a secure rear base into a new battleground for the war, demonstrating both the Russians' vulnerability and the Ukrainians' capacity to strike deep behind enemy lines. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, a visiting professor at Dickinson College, and the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Jeff, a very good evening to you. At first, it was an incident at an airbase, Saki Airbase, several warplanes destroyed, and the witticism from one wag in Kyiv, I believe, was a lot of dropped cigarettes, referring to an accident. Then it was an explosion at what was said to be an ammo depot and a substation in Crimea, somewhere near a train line. The word sabotage was used. Is this the long-sought counteroffensive? Good evening to you, Colonel.
John, good evening to you. It may be an element of the counteroffensive, but I think it also underscores the cooperation between perhaps special operations and perhaps partisan activity behind the lines in Crimea. And actually, I think, John, it's actually the third incident, because if you go back to the 31st of July, there was an attack that disrupted and caused a postponement of Russian Navy Day there in Crimea, which is where the Black Sea Fleet is headquartered. There's no doubt about it that these seem to be occurring very effectively. And it's important to realize that from the perspective of Mr. Putin in particular and the Russians in general, they consider Crimea to be Russian territory. Probably the most popular thing Mr. Putin did in his entire 22 years in power was to have annexed Crimea in 2014. So this will be a direct blow, not only in terms of the war and recovering Ukrainian territory, which they lost some 8 years ago in some ways, but also many would say strikes very closely to Mr. Putin and his personal legitimacy. He has called Crimea, for example, a holy land. He has called it Russia's sacred place. So this is, I think, very significant and suggests perhaps not only the counteroffensive, but also a whole new escalation in the war as the Ukrainians strike what the Russians would argue is actually the homeland and their territory.
You have taught repeatedly, tactics are for amateurs, logistics are for professionals. Is Crimea a logistical vulnerability for Russia?
I think it is absolutely a logistic vulnerability. First and foremost, it is at the end of this Russian advance, if you look at the map on where the Russians have gone. We know the Russians have had a difficult time with their supply networks since this war actually began, and was one of the reasons why they failed the initial offensive against Kyiv and Kharkiv. And now we see the disruption by the Ukrainians becoming more effective all along that supply line, not only with these special operations missions over the last few weeks, but also using longer range fires like the HIMARS. And a lot of what they're doing is disrupting command and control networks. They're disrupting or destroying rail networks. The Russians depend on the rail networks a great deal to move heavy equipment and heavy ammunition. And furthermore, of course, for a host of reasons, the Black Sea Fleet, which the Russians were going to depend upon a lot, I think, for amphibious warfare or offensive along this coastline or for providing fire support, is staying far out to sea in the aftermath of the destruction of the Moskva and the effective use of anti-ship missiles by the Ukrainian, basically eliminating that amphibious warfare capability as something the Russians can depend on in that particular area.
The reporting day by day, especially at the Institute for the Study of War, shows a front line that does not move, that describes artillery exchanges or missile exchanges. That appears to be what the war has come to, but that requires an arsenal, a bottomless arsenal. Does that exist for either side?
Well, the Russians have always, by their doctrine back in the days of the Soviet Union, depended on artillery as the prime killer on the battlefield. Artillery was something they emphasized. And as a consequence, they have massive amounts of artillery tubes as well as the associated ammo. But the Russians in the Donbas region over the last couple of weeks have been reported to firing somewhere between 40 and 60,000 artillery rounds a day as they continue to try to grind up the offensive, now having taken Luhansk province also trying to take Donetsk. Ukrainians are responding probably with about a tenth of that, but have been more successful, I think, in the accurate delivery of artillery fire and now longer-range artillery fire using the HIMARS. But this is, you know, if it goes for a long period of time, as it certainly appears it might, this becomes a war of the industrial base. Do both sides have the capacity, or do their allies have the capacity to continue to provide ammunition, resupply, and weaponry at these high rates? You know, John, and this is unclassified, but I just examined the United States Army for the fiscal year 23 budget only requested a purchase of about 90,155 artillery rounds for the United States. And we have a lot in stockpile, but we've been giving the Ukrainians tens of thousands of projectiles that they're going through in a pretty rapid pace. Even at 6,000 rounds a day, that's only 15 days of supply. In addition, for fiscal year 23, the U.S. Army only requested the purchase of about 23 HIMARS launchers and about 4,600 rockets. And we're still transferring launchers and rockets to them, again, out of our stocks. And you can't just ramp up that kind of industrial capacity overnight. So I know already from what I've heard that people in the Pentagon are already starting to scratch their head and say we need an industrial policy now that expands that production rate dramatically. We need to do that as quickly as possible.
That's the arsenal of democracy. That was what they called upon in 1941, 42 to win the war. But there's a pause, Jeff. Even when they knew that the fleet was coming online, they had to get through those first 6 months or 10 months in 1942 through Guadalcanal before the big carriers started to arrive. So there will be a pause. If they do engage the arsenal of democracy, it can't deliver tomorrow. It's not eBay.
Exactly. And there's not an alternative. Our European partners have also allowed their industrial bases to largely atrophy in the aftermath of the Cold War. There's not huge constituencies for democracies to buy artillery shells. People want to buy sophisticated weapons or high-performance aircraft or spy satellites, but you know, plain old garden variety artillery shells don't normally have large constituencies. So we've seen that atrophy. And then on top of that, you know, the recent dust-up, the recent crisis that occurred after Mrs. Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, war games that I have talked to people about that have been done in the Pentagon about an engagement between the United States and China. Trust me, we go through precision-guided weapons such as anti-ship missiles, Stingers, Javelins, et cetera, at a dramatic rate. And then again, there you are back to that industrial base and the arsenal of democracy.
Is there an escalation of weaponry underway? Can you tell, Colonel? I mention this only because I ran into a report that HARM missiles are now being sent to Ukraine. Now, HARMs can be fired from the ground, but they're chiefly associated with airstrikes. They go in first because they blind the adversary. HARMs look like a really good weapon if you're going to go on the offensive. So, again, is escalation underway from what you can tell in the arsenal?
I think to a degree, or at least the reluctance that the Biden administration talked about early on in this war, that by providing longer range weapons or more sophisticated weapons, they might, in fact, cause Russians to consider escalation. Don't forget that dust up about, John, we had back then about transferring old MiG aircraft from Poland right to the Ukraine that were going to go through Germany, and that all fell apart. That was early on in the war. I think that, if it happened again, would happen very swiftly and may do so. I've already seen talk about transferring A-10 aircraft, which I'm sure the Ukrainians would love to have, or perhaps even more sophisticated aircraft to Ukraine, or again, transferring them to NATO partners who still have older aircraft and passing those on to the Ukrainians. But again, when you start talking about sophisticated weaponry, you're back to this question of the absorption rate and how long does it take to train a pilot on an aircraft that his nation has never had before. And then furthermore, how do you put in place the logistical base that sustains that piece of equipment, whether it's an aircraft, a helicopter, or a ground-based piece of equipment, in terms of maintenance, resupply, special ammunition for it, and the like? That becomes the problem when you talk about more and more sophisticated weaponry.
What is the International Legion, to your understanding?
Yeah, the International Legion are people, civilians who have flocked to Ukraine to fight for Ukraine. And the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense says right now that the International Legion represents 55 countries in terms of people who have come to Ukraine to fight for Ukraine, that the soldier base is in excess of 20,000. About 30% of those soldiers, according to the Ukrainians now, John, are Americans. About 20% are Brits, and about 7% are Germans. And then it goes down from there. Not unlike something you and I know from our study of history, in that if you go back to the Spanish Civil War, of course, you had the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which was in many ways sort of a historical metaphor for the International Legion in Ukraine. The U.S. government has tried to discourage Americans from participating in this. We have had a few Americans that were killed in action that we know of. We have had a few Americans that have been captured. And for these international soldiers, it's a real question what the Russians will do with, to them if they're captured. The Russians have made some suggestion, or their puppets, the Luhansk People's Republic or Donetsk People's Republic, if they're captured there, may actually try them as terrorists. And there have even been recent suggestions that in some places there, they are constructing cages and courtrooms, which may be the precursor for those type of show trials if they have captured anybody from the International Legion.
Jeff, a detail about where we are in the war right now. I have read anecdotes that there are trainers in the region, trainers for the Ukrainian civilians to become soldiers. Have you heard the same thing? Trainers, not volunteers to fight on the front line, but, you know, master sergeants, that scale.
I think some of the International Legion people, from talking to people I know in Ukraine, are providing that kind of assistance. Normally, it's my understanding from talking to Ukrainians that to join the International Legion, one has to show that you have had previous military experience. And I'm sure they would call out those who have had significant experience to act as trainers. And of course, I do know that several NATO countries have offered to train Ukrainians, but all that training is occurring outside of Ukrainian territory. I think there's a movement foot, for example, to train some Ukrainian soldiers as far away as Great Britain. That may be driven again by not only are you training them for, you know, basic combat skills, but training them on sophisticated pieces of equipment that are then going to be transferred to Ukraine. And in fact, Ukrainians that I've talked with in the Ministry of Defense are very adamant that we need to start the training as soon as we even begin the discussion of a transfer of military equipment, even before it's approved, so we can speed the process of not only of the soldier who's trained on it. So when the equipment arrives, we already have trained people on the ground that can employ it.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, U.S. Army retired, CBS News, a visiting professor at Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. 1 year since departure from Afghanistan, since NATO and the U.S. left behind chaos. What has happened? What has been learned in that year about the war that was fought in Afghanistan, about the next time the U.S. and its allies involved themselves in guerrilla war? Next, I'm John Batchelor.